Thank you, Father, for these comfortable surroundings. And Lord, as we come and rest ourselves, in a sense, we do not want to be passive or too relaxed, because now our minds need to be alert to what you have to say to us through your word. There are things that you want to teach us tonight, because we are going to have a responsibility someday to minister in a situation that will be discussed. Somewhere along the line, Father, you will probably bring us into the gap to minister to someone very near to us, perhaps, Lord, to ourselves directly, when this crisis comes. And so now may our hearts be open, and may the Spirit be our teacher, in Christ's name. Amen. We've got some loose ends. It's been a couple of weeks. Let's see. One week I was sick, about to die. The next week I was on vacation. Though I had recuperated before vacation, I don't want to lead you astray. I was well rested when I went on vacation. But it was nice to get away last week. Thank you, John, for filling in. And tonight, we're back at 2 Samuel. I've got some loose ends I need to tie up. This is homiletically a little awkward. And we have the remainder of a message that I did not finish 2 weeks ago. I have to finish that and then try to start another unit. So you'll roll along with me, I hope, on this. And John's going to be grading me tonight. We've been talking about grading homiletics and that kind of thing. So let's go at it. Here's the situation that actually began in chapter 11, David's sin. I entitled chapter 11 and chapter 12, The Fall of a Righteous Man and How He Gets Up. All of us can identify with David, because we've all fallen in some way along the line. It may not have been quite as dramatic, or quite the implications may not have been as far-reaching, but we've fallen in some way. Now, in the 11th chapter, David fell in his sin. He committed adultery with Bathsheba. And to make matters worse, he tried to cover his sin with sin. He multiplied it. For about a year, David did nothing about his sin. Nothing. It must have been bewildering. During that year, as he would sit out upon the palace and up on the upper story in the palace and would think over this incident, and he was suffering that year. He was not getting off scot-free. Psalm 51 describes, or rather Psalm 32 and Psalm 38 describe that year, how traumatic it was. Then finally God sent a man to David to put him in the corner, Nathan. Nathan gave him a little story. I got a story I want to tell you, David. And David, being the emotional fellow he was, he got right into the plot. There was a good guy and there was a bad guy, and David immediately identified with the guy in the white hat, and he said, that guy in the black hat really deserves it. And then Nathan says, you're the guy in the black hat, David. So David was nailed. Now what does a righteous man do when he's confronted with his sin? He does what David did. He acknowledged his sin to the Lord, and he confessed his sin. It was restored to the joy of his fellowship. That is exactly the opposite of the way Saul was when he was confronted with his sin. You compare the two, and you'll see the difference between an unrighteous man and a righteous man, which makes me further believe that Saul was not a believer. I do not see any flicker of spiritual perception in Saul, or maybe some along the way, but that which an unbeliever could have. But David was a righteous man. He fell, but when he fell, he saw his sin. When he finally was confronted with it, he confessed his sin. But that's not the end of the story. Beginning in this 12th chapter, I've responded to the content with this title, David's Recovery, or How a Righteous Man Gets Up. I see five distinct movements in this recovery of David. I was in the process of giving you those stages as he develops, comes out of his sin. Very helpful study, because when you come out of your fall, or when you're helping somebody come out of their fall, here are five processes that you may use for instruction. How do you make a recovery? Well, we've covered the first three or four, and I don't want to be unnecessarily redundant, but look, verses 1 to 14, he was confronted with his sin. Then in verse 15, the consequences of his sin. There were definite consequences that came to David because of his sin, which forgiveness did not scotch. That's an important matter. I'm going to come back to this later on. When you deal with sin, you must realize that when you sin, there is a horizontal and a vertical and a horizontal effect of sin. Vertically, it affects your relationship with God, and that, of course, is first and foremost. But horizontally, it affects your relationship with others. What do you do to correct the vertical aspect of it? You confess this sin and you accept the forgiveness of God. What do you do to handle the horizontal implications? The vertical does not mean that the horizontal implications just stop. Nor are you to interpret the horizontal consequences as somehow God's rejection of you. That's what Christians often do. Because of the consequences that are coming on down on them, they think that God has not granted them forgiveness. The mistaken idea is that God should therefore stop all the consequences. He will not. Sin bears its fruit in its season. And so what happens with David is now consequences go right on down through chapters 14, 15, 16, 17, at least five stages, and it's tragic. We see the consequences in verse 15. The consequence was death. Well, there were really two. If you'll see in verses 10 and 11, Nathan said to David, number one, the sword will not depart from your house. It's going to be rebellion, and you're going to see this in chapter 13. Amnon and Absalom are going to be a pain in his neck. His own sons. And then he says also that I will raise up evil against you from your own household. Well, verse 2, I will even make your wife, take your wives before you, give them to your companions. All right, that's Amnon and Absalom. The second one is that he is going to take the life of the child. Bathsheba became pregnant. The child she gave birth to, God said, I'm going to take that child, David. I don't know that that really hit David at the time. He was not emotionally enough involved at that point. He hadn't seen the baby yet. But I guarantee when the baby came and he saw that child, he's like any parent. He's like any parent that sees that newborn life. Look what David went through. Verses 12 or 15 to 23 describes this consequence. So Nathan went to his house. That's after he's confronted David. Then the Lord struck the child that Uriah's widow bore to David, so that he was very sick. What do you do when you have a sick child? You parents who've had sick children, you know the helpless feeling. It's not like when an adult is sick. They've learned to tell you about the symptoms. You know, it's like this. I think this is probably what's wrong. A child just knows that this hurts, or if they've got a fever. And you know they're hurting, but they don't know all of what's happening. And David seemed to have been particularly fond of children. This was his child now who's sick. And David therefore inquired of God for the child, and David fasted and went all and lay all night on the ground. He loved children, and he loved this child. It was his son. The elders of the household stood beside him in order to raise him up from the ground, but he was unwilling and would not eat food with them. Then it happened on the seventh day that the child died. The servants were afraid to tell him what had happened. David suspects something, though. He hears them off to the side and whispering it. David knows. God had told him that the child was going to die. He puts two and two together, and he perceived that the child was dead. David said to his servants, "Is the child dead?" He said, "He's dead." So David arose from the ground, washed, anointed himself, put on lotions, changed his clothes, came into the house of the Lord and worshipped. Then he came to his own house, and when he requested, they set food before him. Now this bewildered the servants. David, you were on your face all night, out of doors, without food, in great grief. The baby's dead, and now you're up and about. Why was there a change so quick? He said, "When the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, and I said, 'Who knows, the Lord may be gracious to me, and the child may live.' But now he has died, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." Now, I've got two. There are a couple of things here I want to give to you. They're only in seed form. I think there's a subject here that at least it opens up, and it may help you somewhere along the line. It may help us more than we realize someday. But can I do two things here? Number one, notice how David responds to chastisement. He's losing a child. I see three factors here in responding to chastisement. When God sends discipline, you won't find a better response to it than you've got right here. How do you respond to chastisement? What if God takes one of your children? And that wouldn't have to be because of chastisement necessarily. What if God takes one of your children, my children? Some have suggested that's the greatest tragedy. What would you do? Well, look, I want to deal with that along this line. Notice, number one, David prayed for the one directly affected by his chastisement. David prayed for the child who was affected because of David's sin. If you're part of your chastening is that somebody else is experiencing the fallout from it, David prayed for that child. Secondly, he put the loss and hurt into God's hands. Why do you think he was fasting and praying? He wanted God to relieve this child. It's like a parent. He wanted relief for this child. Perhaps God could raise this child up. David laid hold of God, and David put it into God's hands. That is a key factor in David's life. You may wonder why a man could be called a man after God's own heart and have had this blemish, but you've got to remember David's total life, and the thing that always marks David is that David came back to God. He laid hold of God. He knew who God was, and he could trust God. So he put this whole hurt and pain into God's hand. He humbled himself under the mighty hand of God, submitted to it. He didn't resist this chastisement. He didn't grow bitter. Oh, God, why are you doing this to me? Third factor is that he put the death of the child behind him and refused to live in self-pity. Now, that's what astounded the servants. He didn't wallow around in self-pity and go on with his mourning days after. He took his medicine. He took his medicine. And the reason he could take his medicine, he knew his doctor. And God was administering the medicine, and David was taking it. Now that leads me to something else, and this came on me late this afternoon, and it suggested a whole subject, a whole message really. When an infant dies, I don't know of immediate situation in our assembly where this is necessary because of immediate pain, but it may come in your life, in my life. We've lost a child previous to birth. Some of you may have. When an infant dies, I want to suggest that this passage gives us some principles to work on. Before I say that, I have noticed something. I was thinking about this after putting the principles down here. I have known men, outstanding men in Christian service, leadership, who've lost a child. I'm not going to make any universal principle here, but it seems quite often that this, can I use the phrase the ultimate tragedy? It's a very painful blow to take. It's interesting how often men in leadership have had to suffer this. Dr. Fleece, Mr. and Mrs. Fleece, lost a son. He was the president of Columbia Bible College at one time. They lost a son. He went out one afternoon in an automobile. The car went off the shoulder of the road. It was in Florida. Hit some sand. Turned over. Boy was killed. He was a teenager. John Walford, president of Dallas Seminary, lost a son who was in pre-med school. This, I think, just about a year or two ago. There are others that come to mind. I won't take you through those, but what happens when you lose a child, an infant or a child, as the case may be? I think there are six factors here. Let me give them to you quickly. We don't have time to linger on them, but I think they can be of help. Number one, take refuge in God. Take refuge in God. This is the only place you'll have refuge. Remember, His providence is always conducted on moral principles, always. God does not snatch away by just arbitrary reasons. His providence works on the basis of moral principles. Take refuge in God. I mean, you can't answer all the questions, and you're hurting. You're in great pain. You've lost a child, but take refuge in God. You may not be able to utter a word. Just be quiet in front of Him, before Him. The second factor that is involved is commit the infant, if it is an infant, to the mercy of God. If it's pre-birth or very young, shall I say, before the age of accountability, at least there is question, did the child have any knowledge about eternal matters, about God, the gospel? Commit the child, the infant, to the mercy of God. Now, I mean by this two things. The mercy of God is an extension, expression of His love, an attribute of God. Mercy is the pity that God has, and He can be merciful because of His justice. See, love comes out because of His justice. God's justice has been satisfied on the cross. The mercy of God must be looked at in relation to an infant and what the infant has been taken to and what the infant has been kept from. I believe that the infant has been taken to the Lord. I believe that this is the weight of theology. I don't have a proof text for it. Some try to use verse 19, or rather verse 23. I think it's probably really straying, and the only way you can do it is that you know your New Testament theology. I don't know that David knew all about the afterlife, that he was going to be in heaven with. I believe he was committed to trusting God that he would join his child in death. And David knew he was a believer, so we could say that he was believing that God in His mercy had taken that child where he would join him. But I believe that God is provided because of the satisfaction of His justice, and that the gospel appeal is addressed to volition and the rational mind, which the child has not been able to exercise. He cannot respond because his volition is not able to handle them. His mind is not able to handle the information. So I lay it before a merciful God what the child has been taken to and what the child has been kept from. If that child had grown up, what possibly could have come into that life that could have been disastrous? Maybe it would have been a home life that would have been absolutely tragic in its effects on that child. Thirdly, ask God this. What do you want to teach me, Lord? This is where wisdom... That's the passage in James 1. If any of you lack wisdom, and the context is what? Suffering. You need wisdom in suffering. How to match up your doctrine with the experience. That's wisdom. Ask God, what are you teaching me? In David's case, I think David recognized it, didn't he? It was a very clear relationship. Now, it may not be chastisement. It may be for other purposes that will unfold as the years go along. But ask God to teach you and be responsive to His Word. Fourthly, don't become bitter. Don't become bitter. Or try to replace the child. Now, I want to qualify. I want to explain that statement. Let God do the replacement. You might be tempted emotionally to run right out and adopt. Or to have another child if you're still able to, and you want to try to replace. That motive could be suspect. Give yourself time and seek God and allow God to make sure God is leading you for a replacement, as it were. The child will never be replaced. But if God does want to bring His, shall we say, replacement, give yourself time. Don't make rash decisions behind the veil of tears. The veil of tears often can blur your perception, so be careful. Five, a husband and wife need to look out for one another at a time like that more than any other time, looking out for one another. David went in to comfort Bathsheba. Husband and wife need to look out for one another. Each of them have similar needs but distinct needs, and that's where love will be a great... will be cohesive in the relationship. They will comfort one another. Sixth, get back to living. Get back to living. David picked himself up out of the ground. took a bath, put a new change of clothes on. He accepted his medicine. He went on. Oh, I'm sure that he felt this loss. But he did not go off and become a recluse. He did not become a basket case. He moved back to what we would say would be normal scheduling. A person who has a hard time getting back to normal scheduling after a reasonable time, you have to wonder if there's been, if everything has been resolved. And I want to be careful here. We're all different. It's going to take some a little longer probably to recover. But David does give us, I think, some example on how to apply your theology to the crisis, in the crisis. All right, that was just an aside. That was not. I haven't gotten to the main point yet, so let's get along. Four, the fourth movement here. All right, after the consequence, David confesses his sin, 13 and 14. Thirdly, the consequence of the sin. Fourthly, verse 24, comfort after the sin. There's the point I've just raised. Comfort of one another, and then God gives them a child, Solomon. Shalom. Who is he? Peace. Why do you think they called him Child of Peace? That's what his name means. Why, maybe David and Bathsheba saw, particularly David saw, as I'm sure he was the one responsible for naming him, in naming Solomon, that he was saying by this name that God has granted us peace. So there was comfort. And then in verses 26 to 31, confirmation after his sin. Now, Joab fought against Rabbah. We go back all the way back to verse 25 of chapter 11 here. For there was, all of that was an interlude. Now we go back to the battle. Over to the eastern side of the Dead Sea, or Jordan River, there was a battle going on. This is the one that David should have been in to begin with. He would not have been involved with Bathsheba if he'd been out and if he'd gone to work like he should have gone to work instead of laying out that day. He laid out, and now he's out to battle. He's out at Rabbah. The city is captured. Now what happens? So David gathered all the people, went to Rabbah there, fought against it, captured it. He took the crown of their king from his head with a weight as a talent of gold, about 75 pounds, some kind of crown, wasn't it? And it was a precious stone, and it was placed on David's head, and he brought it out the spoil of the city in great amounts. Oh, maybe a little hall of victory in some ways. It wouldn't be, it didn't have quite the luster that it would have if he had not sinned. But yet, the fact that there is victory, maybe it's this saying, God in his providence is reassuring David that God will bless David. David will have to go through some deep waters yet, but God will bless him. He's been restored. So verse 31 is simply saying that David put them to hard labor, put the citizens, the sons of Ammon, to hard labor. Now we're ready for the message tonight, chapter 13. The fall of David's family. The fall of David's family. This chapter is in two distinct sections. Verses 1 to 22, Amnon's lust. Verses 23 to 39, Absalom's revenge. This is the fulfillment of what Nathan said to David in chapter 12, verses 10 and 11. You get it right away. Amnon's lust and Absalom's revenge. Now, these first 22 verses are not easy to teach to a mixed company, particularly with young ears. But we've got to do it. There is a moral lesson. Some people try to make it appear as if the Bible is a book which is a bit racy, sort of pornographic. People actually accuse the Bible of that kind of thing. They, for the most part, are, well, obviously they're poorly informed. The Bible makes definite statements about the events that it records. Maybe not in the immediate context, but in the larger context, the Bible addresses sin. Now, what we have in these 22 verses are the consequences of sin in David's life. Maybe we need to stop and give a little background to these 22 verses, this whole chapter and the subsequent rebellion of Absalom. When a father or mother fail to provide moral leadership, as they should, some kind of vacuum is created in the family. Children are very impressionable, particularly in their relationship to their parents. Because, you know, to some extent, children look at their parents almost, they're God to them. To a certain age, they are God. God can only, children are very concrete in their attitudes, relationships. They look at their parents, and you can imagine how David's family must have looked at him, the king, and the poet, the musician, the king, the warrior, this man of God. And David's life, you recall that his fall did not just take place in chapter 12. We traced it back and saw that him multiplying his wives, this was a tragedy. So this was something that had been going on. Now he's going to start reaping the consequences of that. So to some extent, a parent is responsible for the waywardness of their children. Not completely, but they do share some of the blame. David shares part of the blame for the fall of his children here. A second factor I think is important as we study these chapters, not only this 13th, but the others, that you can see the consequences of sin move from one generation to the next, don't they? They go from one generation to the next. And David sinned by multiplying his wives, committing adultery with Bathsheba, having Uriah murdered. That in chapter 12 and verse 10, what did it say? The sword will never depart from your house, David. So the evil effects of sin don't go away because you've been forgiven. David was forgiven, but. Now we get to look at the future. Now some things could have been corrected, and I've got to run in and say this quickly before I leave. I don't want to give the impression that all of this was just, would have happened to David, that he couldn't have done something as it was happening to him. I find David not only failed, but he kept failing. If you watch it carefully, he's too lenient on these boys. When Amnon sins, he gets mad. Well, I know a lot of parents who get mad when their child is wrong, but that's not the whole story. If it's just anger, that's not enough. He doesn't do anything to punish him. Nothing. Nothing in the record. When Absalom runs away, does David do anything about Absalom's fleeing from him? Does he go out and get him? No. I found a father who's lenient here. Why do you think? I want to offer a suggestion in a minute on that. But David could have scotched some of this behavior if he had moved in on the situation. It's bad enough as it is, but he lets it snowball on him. Now we're ready for this section. Let me take you through these 22 verses and the sin of Amnon. Here's the way it works. First of all, we see the record of Amnon's lust. Verses 1 to 14. Look what happens. There's lust. What was the occasion for this lust? Now I'm wording it carefully here. Not love, lust. Now, it was after this that, or in the course of time, that Absalom, the son of David, now this was David's child by Maachah. She was the daughter of King of Geshur, one of the wives that he had taken. And here it was against the law, and he's going to reap for that. Had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. She was his full sister. But Amnon, the son of David, loved her. This was her half-brother. Amnon was David's son by Ahinoam, the judge of the Jezreelites. So we got a half-brother, half-sister. Amnon lusted after Tamar, his half-sister. That's the occasion. Amnon, it says in verse 2, and we get the pattern of this lust. Look at the pattern of the lust. It goes through four distinct stages here. First of all, there was frustration in this lust. This is the way lust, very interesting dissection of the way lust works. First of all, frustration. He wanted to sleep with Tamar so badly that he was frustrated because of his sister Tamar that he made himself ill, for she was a virgin and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. That it seemed, the word here that's translated seemed hard, the Hebrew means that it was beyond his power. He did not see how he could accomplish, fulfill his lust because of the social restrictions. Those social restrictions are important. I kid you not, they are important. And when a society removes those restrictions and makes it easier for things like this to happen, you see how lust will go and fulfill its objective? That's why restraints are so important. I'm talking about law enforcement. I'm talking about community values, that kind of thing. I turned news on this morning just for a minute, just to catch it on the Today Show, about 5 minutes of news. They had some girl substituting for Jane Pauley, and she makes this statement. I turn it off. She talked about weddings, and she said, I would live with my I lived with my boyfriend 15 years, and then I decided before the wedding that we wouldn't get married. And she was all grinning about it, and that was it. You just can't turn it on without just 15 years. Now, impressionable folk out there just, and what that does is that it makes it an accepted norm in society. When enough people who are impressing other people get on there and cackle over it, and there's no stigma attached to it. She lived in sin, fornication, for 15 years. When you've got a lust pattern that's going wild, you can find support. And he did, and look where it came from. Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very shrewd man. There seemed to have been some a genetical propensity towards shrewdness in David's family. He said to him, O son of the king, why are you depressed morning after morning? The Hebrew word here means you. Why are you so low, weak? It's that very word that's used in Genesis where it talks about the seven cows, the seven weak, the seven weak ones. He said, why are you coming all down in the mouth, emaciated looking? He was not hungry. His lust pattern was so intense, and he was going to have it fulfilled, but he was frustrated. He was losing his appetite, and he was actually depressed. Now, if he had gone to a shrink today, what do you think the secular shrink would have told him to do in view of this situation of his depression? Well, you can cogitate on that a bit, but let's go. Verse 6. Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. Oh, Jonadab gives him this advice. Now, here's David's nephew. Oh, this family. Jonadab said to him, lie down on your bed, pretend to be ill. When your father comes to see you, say to him, please let my sister Tamar come and give me some food to eat. Let her prepare the food in my sight that I may see it and eat it in her hand. Well, what he wants to do, of course, get her in the house. Get her in the house. Take it from there. Amnon lay down, pretended to be ill. And the king came to see him. David came in. Amnon said to the king, please let my sister Tamar come and make me a couple of cakes in my sight that I may eat from her hand. The Hebrew word here for cakes, it is levoth. Levoth, it's the root of it, is the word leave, the word heart. Some have suggested you could a heart cake. It was shaped like a heart, but it was like a pastry. And it must have been a very, for the life of me, I can't think of wanting pastry when you're sick. When we get sick at our house, could somebody go get the Canada Dry or something like that? Get something, some fluids. But he wanted this. And it must have flattered her a little bit. And he wanted it. He was sick. And so that was the request. He lies. See, he's creating a situation that's going to be to his advantage. That's the way lust works. Oh, lust can be so imaginative. When you want to fulfill that lust, you start manipulating people. You go to the people who give you support, and you come up with a brainstorm. And Tamar went to brother Amnon's house, and come on down to verse 11. And she came in, and she made the little cakes, and he asked everybody to leave the room, and he's got her there by himself. And then he took her hold of her and said, "Come, lie with me, my sister." And the final pattern in the lust pattern, you see how it goes, frustration, he finds support, then he has a plan, and now there's a suppression of her will. His lust is so strong that he does not care anything about her concerns, her care. That's the way lust works. This is not love. Love would be concerned for what is going to hurt her, but this is lust, and all lust is interested in is satisfying that lust. It's purely internal, it's focused solely on the individual, and it's pride. He said, she answered him, "No, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing." The Hebrew here is nevalah. Do you hear something in there? Nevala, Neval. This is foolish. This is foolishness. In other words, this is spiritual Harry Carey. This is spiritual stupidity. As for me, where could I get rid of my reproach? Whether we like it or not, the female suffers more. Why? Because she bears the marks more physically in pregnancy. They both lose virginity. But she bears special reproach, particularly in the culture. That's what she's saying. How will I get rid of my reproach? And as for you, you will be like one of the fools, there's that word, Nabal, in Israel. Now therefore, please speak to the king. He will not withhold you from me. She's trying any angle she can. Talk to dad. And the law actually forbade this type of thing in Leviticus 18:9. It was not really legal. Now, it's just conjecture as to why she brings this up. Didn't she know it was illegal? Maybe they were overlooking this part of the law. However, he would not listen to her. Since he was stronger than she, he raped her. That's his lust. Lust, sin, and now we get the actual consequences that come. Look at verse 15. Amnon hated her with a very great hatred, for the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he loved her. And Amnon said to her, "Get up. Get out!" Why does he respond that way? If he really loved her. I mean, if there were real biblical love here. I say, number one, he really didn't love her in the full sense. Not the genuine sense. He lusted after her. Secondly, why was she so repulsive to him now? Because, number one, she stimulated his guilt. To see her reminded her of him of the wrong. She was a guilt stimulator. He realized what he had done. And her presence there just was salt in the wound. So, what happens? Look at her. It's pitiful. She said, No, because this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other that you've done to me. You know what he's trying to do here? Listen, this boy not only lusts, he wants to make her to get the blame for it. I mean, he wants it to look like she came in there and seduced him. That's how sorry this boy is. Then he called his young man who attended him and said, "Throw this woman out of my presence. Lock the door behind her. She tried to come in here and seduce me." She reminds me of the female counterpart to that. Do you remember Potiphar's wife? In an interesting parallel, isn't it? The way they worked she was trying to seduce Joseph. Joseph resisted. And then she got mad at Joseph. She didn't really love Joseph. This was lust. That's why so often you hear all these killings in these so-called triangle love affairs. It's not love there. This is lust. Warring against lust is what it is. And Amnon is attempting to shift the blame. He wants to make it look like she's come in and seduced him. And, well, there's the statement that she held in this long sleeve garment. This indicated her place in society, this garment like which Joseph wore as a teenager. She goes out, puts ashes on her head, tore her long sleeve garment, which was on her, put her hand on her head, went away, crying aloud as she went. Now, this boy was obligated to protect her. He, though, tries to cover his sin with a sin. Did anybody else do that? David did. It's happening right under his nose now. This boy is doing the same thing he did. Now, does that mean that David was just toothless? That he couldn't have done anything? Amnon could have looked at him and says, "Well, Dad, look what you did. You can't do anything." "Oh, no. David said, "Listen, son, I have dealt with my sin before God, and there is some discipline. You need to go before the judges." That's what he should have done. Don't try that. Sometimes this will happen. People try to throw your sin back in your face to try to get out from their responsibility. No. Don't let your children ever do that. They say, "Well, Dad or Mom, you said this." Now, if you've never dealt with it, that's one thing, and you're trying to get the telephone pole out of somebody else's house before you get the toothpick out of yours, that's something you'll have to deal with. But if they're throwing back some past failure of yours that you've dealt with, you ought not to let that get by. David should have done something here. He should have moved in. Well, Absalom, her brother, said to her, "Has that Amnon, your brother, been with you?" "Keep silent, sister. He's your brother. Do not take this matter to heart." So Tamar remained and was desolate. She's laid waste in her brother Absalom's house. And when David heard of these matters, he was angry. But Absalom did not speak to Amnon, either good or bad. He didn't say a thing. And he hated Amnon because he had violated his sister. You know what Absalom was doing? Shrewd Absalom. He was already scheming, "I'm just going to cool it. I'm going to make everybody think that we're not all that upset. But somewhere down the line, I'm going to get him." How about premeditated? That's what I'll do. There is a conniving customer. He's going to do the same thing on his dad too later, this conspiracy in overthrowing David. This Absalom was a sorry fellow too. But they're David's boys. And it's easy for us to look at somebody else's children and, hey, they're out of line. But when it becomes your own, it's hard to move in and deal with it. Not that you shouldn't. It's hard. So that's the story up to there. We've got Absalom's revenge next. I've got about 12 minutes, and I've got something that you need at this point. Whether I get Absalom tucked in this picture or not, I'll get him in chapter 14, so I'm not worried. I've got something that goes with a study that we dealt with in Genesis 33 to 35. And that subject title was How to Handle a Scandal. You remember that? Genesis 33 to 35, when a moral crisis hits your home. I get a call like this about every couple, 3 months. Moral crisis hits a family. For example, daughter becomes pregnant before marriage. Son picked up on drug charges. Son gets drunk, wrecks family car. One child hates the other child, so much so that there is just awful tension around the house. Son or daughter is living with another person, not married. It's going down the line. What do you do when a moral crisis hits your children? Not somebody else's children, your children. I want to suggest some principles for action here. Number one, if this happens, and don't think you are above it. If it happens, number one, examine your own heart and life to see if and how you failed. Now, this isn't the only point. I'm not laying all the guilt here on you. But it does become a principle. I mean, it's where you have to start to deal with the other things. If you realize that you look at your son or daughter and you see them fail, you've got to start examining your own heart. Where did you fail? I'd ask two questions. Number one, is there unconfessed sin in my life? If I've been going through months and years without dealing with sin in my life, is God chastening me through these consequences to my sin? Maybe the purpose in this is to get me back into fellowship. I mean, God can overrule and use sin to that purpose. He didn't cause it, but He can use it for that sin. The failures, if you determine that the failure was before you became a Christian, or maybe it's a failure that you've been guilty of since becoming a Christian that was sometime earlier, which you've handled, but it was a failure. You know, you were living a certain way while your child was, say, 1 to 7, and then God gets a hold of you, but that child's about 10. What about all that you've sown for those years? Remember the consequences? And some parents, this is a great struggle for some parents. I mean hardship. Because a parent gets right with God, maybe they become a Christian in their 40s or 50s, but yet they've reared children, and they've reared them according to carnal ways. They've not taught and raised them in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, and now they see what they've done. That's a burden. What's a parent going to do? Let's go to the second principle then. Seek out your children and ask their forgiveness. Seek out the child or the children and ask forgiveness. Acknowledge the wrong committed against them. Acknowledge the wrong. See, this, you accept responsibility. That's not to say that the child is not responsible for what they've done. If that boy's been arrested on a drug charge, that boy's responsible or have to face the music. But you have to respond by realizing you are that child's parent and you have made some contribution. Now, the reason this principle is so important about seeking them and asking their forgiveness is that this is the road to reconciliation with that child, to establish a relationship. I think it ought to be done very quickly. I think it ought to be done personally, in person, if at all possible. Matthew 5 bears that out. This is a way in which you will involve yourself in restitution to that child as well. This focuses attention on the sin. That's really the issue. Here's what I'm getting at. The daughter becomes pregnant. That is a sin, and that is before marriage. But there's got to be some root situations here that got to be dealt with. So what you do when you go and ask forgiveness, you're focusing on a root cause. Do you get what I'm saying? Is that you're not just looking at that this is something that just happened, that something had been happening before this. And this opens up an opportunity to minister to your child. I heard a pastor's testimony a couple of months back. He had been in the ministry and had failed his children. It was a very candid testimony. And it had all the ministers listening quiet. And this man had been in the ministry, but had failed particularly with one of his children. He had gotten into the busy syndrome, and he had been doing good things, but had left the better things undone. And he was having some real problems with one of his children. Some of the people in the church began to come to him, tell him about this child. And he realized that things had really gotten out of hand, and I don't have time to go into all the details. But this man, the child had already grown up and had gotten out of the home. Two of them had. The one teenager was still in the home. What he did is they went to all of the family, got them all together, and asked his forgiveness for his failure. And he asked if they would be willing to meet with him on a certain night of the week, and they would just start from the ground up. And they had a family time, a Bible time, on that night. And the children responded and came, and he taught them, and he built a relationship. Because he humbled himself. He acknowledged his failure. He sought their forgiveness. And though he had failed them, yet he was able to build something because he did that. That's important. A third principle involved is that commit your child to the Lord in prayer. Commit your child to the Lord in prayer. Now, this is particularly important because if the child is grown and out of the home, you feel helpless, don't you? The child is out of the home. So what do? Commit your child to the Lord in prayer. And if they're unsaved, pray for their conversion. Ask God to save them. If they are a believer but need spiritual insight, pray that God will open the eyes of their understanding. Fourthly, learn from your failures by not repeating them. Learn from your failures by not repeating them. Don't go back and commit the same mistakes, the same sins again. God wants to address you with the issue right now that you will not sin again in that way. God wants to raise you up to have a ministry in other ways. It's not over. Leave this child in the hands of a merciful God who will deal with him directly, and you deal with your opportunities in your future by not repeating those sins. Look, there may be children still in the home that you have a responsibility for. If there are children still in the home, maybe the teenagers or the older children have gone out of the home and they're really living in rebellion against God, but you've got a 13 or 14-year-old there. You've got an opportunity with that child. You may not have any children, but they may all be out of the home, but you have grandchildren. You have other children that God may bring across your path, and so God can give you an opportunity to minister them. And listen, ask this question as well when you look at your own failures. How has your relationship been with your husband or wife? And that relationship with your wife or your husband has got to be dealt with. That could very well have been the triggering mechanism for the breakdown to begin with. get to that issue. What is the relationship like with your husband, your wife, right now? Five, accept God's forgiveness by focusing on turning cursing into blessing. Accept God's forgiveness by focusing on turning cursing into blessing. And I want to underscore this one. This is maybe the most important point of them all. Accept God's forgiveness by focusing on turning cursing into blessing. All right, here's what I mean. Number one, you'll do this. You won't live in the past unless it's constructive. Unless you're viewing the past in a constructive way, the means of building for the future. Avoid the sins of self-pity, self-induced guilt, beating, self-flagellation all of the time. You will accomplish nothing. You will impair your own growth. You will bring misery to others. You'll multiply your sin. And remember this. The continued repercussions of past sin do not mean that God is rejecting you right now. Let me repeat that again. The continued repercussions of past sin does not mean that God is rejecting you right now. Do you think God was rejecting David? No, you read Psalm 51. This occurs after Psalm 51. The fact that he was having this trouble with his family falling apart with Amnon and Absalom and all of these conflicts in the home, that was not saying God was rejecting David. And you should not necessarily interpret these problems that you're having because of the consequences of sin as God's rejection of you. Relate your situation to the character of God. That's how you focus on forgiveness. God does not commit double jeopardy. He will not judge you, chastise you for the same sin twice. Sixthly, when your child commits a moral wrong, take immediate biblical action. When your child commits a moral wrong, take immediate biblical action. I'm assuming here the child's still in the home, and so you do have a little more latitude. When your child commits a moral wrong, take immediate biblical action. For instance, if it's your daughter, and she comes home and she tells you that she's pregnant. She's 15, 16 years of age. What do? Your son comes in. His girlfriend's pregnant. What are you going to do? I suggest that you have some procedure like this. The first principle is you work on, they will take responsibility for their sin. Straight through. They've got to take their medicine. Don't you start running around trying to put up all kinds of false cover for them, trying to play God. If they've got some medicine to take, they're going to have to take it. You stand there and you help to support them. But if they've got medicine to take, if it's a drug charge, don't you go and try to get them off the hook by some underhanded scheme. Now, if the judge wants to go into plea bargaining or something, all right, but that's another story. You work through a lawyer, but you should teach them to face their responsibility. Don't let them blame shift, like Amnon was trying to do here. Shift the blame to everybody but himself, blaming his sister for his sin. And it may very well happen that your son may want to blame that girl. It's her fault, he said. It's her fault. You'll see right through that. Don't let them blame shift. Don't let them cover sin with sin. If she's pregnant, the last thing you want to advise is abortion. Parents astound me sometimes with some of the lengths that they will go to cover sin with sin. One of the tragedies in our day is that parents will recommend that their daughter go in for an abortion without batting an eye. A 16-year-old girl who's pregnant, not married, and then they want to get her to go get an abortion. It's like taking a .38 and just putting it up to the head, blowing their brains out. So that girl will have to live with that all of her life. It's like taking a knife and just bring it right across their face and have a 6-inch scar right across there. That's what they'll have on their soul. They'll have that scar. It'll take the grace of God to deal with that scar. An abortion on top of a pregnancy, one of the worst things that they could do. We've got a society that's condoning that, though. And rebuke their sin without rejecting them, too. You rebuke their sin without rejecting them. It's like, never would you say, don't ever come back in my house again. or some parent might say, if you don't get a haircut, you never come back here. Boy, it's quite a price to pay for a haircut. They may take you up on it, too. Well, seven, let's get this final one in. We'll be through. Seven, use whatever disciplinary measures are appropriate and necessary. Of course, if they're still in the home, they're out of the home, you're a little more limited. But use whatever disciplinary measures are appropriate and necessary. You don't want to overlook the fact that some discipline is necessary here. Of course, along with the other factors you're following through on, I haven't gone into those, possibility of putting the child up for adoption, having the child, never an abortion, but those factors. But if it's a younger child, some kind of corporal punishment. If the child comes home, it's been defiant of authority, has gotten into some moral problem at an early age, maybe was caught fooling with some marijuana in the restroom at school, and they're only 10 or 12 or 11. These can happen quite easily. Can happen to your child, just on a dare. Just takes that long. And then your child comes home, and they've got the school calling you. Your child was caught, fifth period today, smoking marijuana. What are you going to do? Well, I think one thing, you're going to have to move right in and deal with it, that the crime, the punishment will fit the crime. Is this a first offense? I mean, you've got to be thinking through these things, realize the severity of it, and find out why they did it. But spanking is maybe necessary, restrictions, loss of privileges. If it's a son who's gotten a girl pregnant before marriage, then he should ask her forgiveness. He should ask forgiveness of the girl's parents. He ought to take responsibility for the child, at least to see that something is done properly for the child. He can't just wash his hands of it and play like it's never happened. He didn't have anything to do with it. He should treat the girl with kindness, considerateness, not like Amnon. Get her out of here! And there's some who try to do this. And they may not say, get her out of here. They say, kill the baby! Just like Amnon. It's exactly what Amnon was trying to do. Wanted to just... watch his hands out. You know Macbeth's wife, though, when you remember her, you can't wash that guilt off. And if it's a son or a daughter and they're living with someone else and they're not married, something that our society really doesn't look all that badly upon, rebuke the sin. Don't play like it's not there. Don't cut them off, though. And go back to the first 5 points and work those through. Work those through. Of course, I hope this wouldn't happen to any of us. But knowing how sin can work and that everybody is finally responsible for their own actions, I know they can happen to us. Children, grandchildren, parents, God puts us in the gap, gives us His Word, and is seeking to teach us and build us up so that we can be in the gap and be ready to minister when the time comes, if and when it comes. Let's pray. Father, may this be used by Your Spirit. Prepare us for that crisis that may be down the road. In the name of Christ, we ask for the preparedness. Amen.